Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, State of the Union, I'm coming away feeling like everything's cool, right?
I think the state of foreign policy in the State of the Union was even less than the usual light foreign policy content in usual States of the Union.
It was like an amuse-bouche of foreign policy.
No, it wasn't even that. It was like one cashew in a mixed nut bowl.
I mean, I personally was concerned he was going to, you know, declare war on North Korea, like right there. On the podium.
So
I'm feeling relieved. Yeah.
Okay.
I also find it interesting that in the last, you know, month or two, the administration has announced open-ended military commitments in both Syria and Afghanistan, and yet neither of them got a mention at all. Like, this is your chance to speak to the American people about why you're doing this stuff.
They don't care about that.
Well, you might be right.
Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the State of the Hashtag Memo Edition. I'm Shane Harris. Hashtag reporter. That's me.
Does that mean you report on hashtags? Or sure. You are a hashtag?
I'm a hashtag reporter. Hashtag real news.
You know that's going to be a beat in the entertainment magazines one of these days.
The hashtag reporter. The hashtag reporter?
Yeah.
Like reporting on hashtags?
Yeah, like whatever the latest Kardashian hashtag is going to be.
I'm sure there's probably like, having worked at an entertainment magazine before, you're right, that probably will happen if it hasn't happened already. And it will be like a little column somewhere in the front of the book, like on a very busy page of stuff.
Right.
And it'll be the intern's job to compile.
Hashtag of the week.
Yeah, exactly. Trending. Well, I think it's funny to have trending in a magazine, but it'll happen. It's probably already happened. Maybe Rational Security listeners are like reading In Touch and Style and can tell us, you know.
Star magazine.
Yeah.
Let us know.
They'll get right on that. Hashtag crickets. I am here in the jungle studio with my good friends Tamara Kaufman-Wittes and Quinta Jurassic. Quinta is back.
Hello, hello.
Hello. She is back at Lawfare.
I've been repatriated.
Repatriated from that horrible institution, the Washington Post.
Oh, couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
Who wants to work there?
We did a little musical too. We were like in the revolving door, like you were on the way out.
I know. I think there was a span of like 5 days in between where there was neither me nor Shane in the building.
Yeah, exactly.
And they were
and
so relieved.
For it.
The Post quality declined precipitously during those 5 days.
Finally.
Well, we're thrilled to have you back on the podcast.
Yeah, it's so great to
be back.
Ben and Susan are both away in undisclosed locations. Not the same undisclosed location.
Although now that President Trump has decided he's going to keep Guantanamo open forever, you know.
You know.
There's a place for them to go.
There's a place. I think we're going to probably have to talk about that on next week's podcast because this week is jam-packed full of stuff we want to get to. First up, there have been major developments in the Russia probe as House Republicans move to declassify a mysterious hashtag memo. And the FBI.
Wait, Russia's our friend.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I forgot. Sorry. It's all good. Hashtag friends. And the FBI's number two steps down. A new book reveals the inner workings of the Israeli spy machine, and smartwatches are giving away U.S. forces' locations while they're jogging. That doesn't sound like a very smart watch.
It's a very smart watch, but maybe not a very smart soldier.
Maybe. We're going to talk about that. Let's first talk about the hashtag memo. So I'm sure listeners are following this pretty closely, but just to bring you up to speed, the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee voted this week to declassify a memo. It's about 4 pages, we're told, written by the staff of the chairman, Devin Nunes, which purports to describe what he sees as malfeasance, corrupt behavior by FBI agents in the Justice Department working on the Russia probe. And we're told that reports have said that it essentially references underlying classified materials produced by the Justice Department and may focus in large part on the process for obtaining a FISA warrant on Carter Page. You remember him?
Former the coffee boy.
No, that was Rich Papadopoulos.
Carter Page is the one with the hat.
Carter Page is like the Chauncey Gardner of the...
Definitely. In more ways than one.
Yeah, he's a treasure. So the memo is obviously Democrats have publicly said they have a lot of issues with this memo and what they see as a tendentious kind of argument that it's making. I want to kind of get into just some of the politics of this maybe first. And Quinta, let me kick this to you, because I mean, obviously here what you have is Republicans and Democrats fundamentally disagreeing about what classified information says, not all of whom have read the underlying classified information, and an attempt to now selectively declassify some things to prove a point. I mean, this is when we talk a lot about politicization of intelligence. I mean, this seems, no matter sort of which side you're on, to be a fairly textbook example of politicizing intelligence.
Yes. I mean, and there are a lot of data points to add to that conclusion. The one I would point to is that Adam Schiff, who's the lead Democrat on the committee, put forward a motion basically to have, I think there was a motion to have the FBI come and brief everyone on the committee, and then later a motion to allow everyone on the committee to see the classified material on which the memo is based before they voted to release it to the public, and the Republicans voted it down. So they decided that they didn't want more information about what was going on before releasing it. I mean, that's just one of many, many, many examples of what's happened here. I mean, I would say what I find really notable is how I first realized that this was going to be a thing when I started seeing it pop up in the Twitter hashtags, mm-hmm. the hashtag release the memo and hashtag right. like FISA memo,
which
I think.
Really caught on fire.
It really caught on fire. And the good people at the Hamilton 68 Project flagged that it was being tweeted a lot by accounts that may be linked to Russian bots. I would also point out, if you went on R the Donald, which is a subreddit that is sort of one of the more noxious pits of Trump support on the internet, you will find people who were all over that and were posting on Reddit about how they were trying to push that hashtag because their, I don't know, belief or faux belief was that it fits into this sort of vast conspiracy theory that I won't bore you with it, but it involves Pizzagate and the Pope. And Mueller is actually working with Trump to prosecute Obama. So there's this vast like ur conspiracy theory, and the memo kind of slotted into that and gained this life. So it's not even the politicization didn't even come from the committee. It comes from the internet, and then the committee kind of glommed onto it.
Okay, so that's like on the fringe of the fringe of the conspiracy theory Trump supporters is that kind of vast conspiracy. But it seems to me that there is a strong dimension of politicking and political framing in what members of Congress have been doing, not just around this memo, but around the idea that the whole investigation of Russian interference in the elections and of the potential collusion or engagement between Russia and the Trump campaign is just all coming from this Steele dossier, and that the Steele dossier is unverified and it's probably crap. And so therefore the whole thing is crap. And that's what this memo relates to, right? This is alleging that the request for renewal of a FISA warrant for Carter Page was based on information from the Steele memo, and therefore it's corrupt and the FBI is abusing its power by relying on the Steele memo. And I think that this is, I guess, two things come out for me here. One is the extent to which Republican members of Congress have not just bought into, but really fully embraced this narrative of a kind of counter conspiracy, that it's not that the Trump people on the Trump campaign were colluding with Russia. It's that the FBI was colluding with Clinton supporters against Trump and against Russia. And they, you know, the politicking around this memo is just evidence of how much they've bought into that. A, B, it the fact that Devin Nunes is able to be the driver of this among congressional Republicans, despite how thoroughly he discredited himself on this issue in the very early days of the Trump administration by making that late night visit to the White House and
the midnight run, they're apparently calling it.
Right. And, you know, and yet congressional Republicans are willing to sort of hold him up as this paragon of, you know, truth telling. And it just says to me how far they're willing to go, how sort of much they're willing to stretch in their quest to stick close to a very, very tainted president.
And on that point, too, one of the things I'm fascinated by is, you know, because there, I think I'm probably on safe ground saying that there is not a universally held opinion in the Republican caucus in the House that Devin Nunes is just right on about all of this. And right. I mean, he has a history of, you know, making some pretty big pronouncements that don't really tend to hold up. So is the desire, do you guys think, on the part of Republicans to let this go forward because there's some real belief that there is a conspiracy? Or is it more that this is a useful tactic to muddy the water and sort of let, you know, Nunes do his thing? And it appears to, by the way, already be having some kind of effect insofar as that, you know, the idea that there's corrupt actors working in the FBI and the Justice Department, I think is something that probably is resonating with a lot of people. Also, given that Andrew McCabe, the number two of the FBI, just stepped down this week, you know, for different reasons, but that will be read by some people as, see, we're cleaning house and there's a need to get these people out.
Yeah, so I would say, Shin, to the first point about the question of how many members of the Republican caucus actually trust the memo. So Ben and I did a little reporting project where called up the offices of everyone on the majority of the committee, minus Nunes, because we already know what he thinks. We didn't call the Democrats because we already know what they think. They've been unified in their opposition to this, to ask basically, do you have confidence in the factual conclusions in the memo? And most people refused to respond after we bothered them repeatedly. And only 3 of the 12 would say that they had confidence in the memo's factual claims.
Only 3 out of 12.
3 out of 12. Yeah, exactly.
One wonders how many of them actually know what the factual claims in the memo are. I mean,
well, that's the thing. They have no way to evaluate it.
Right.
I mean, and so I would also say, I think that these ideas, they begin at the fringe and they move toward the center. And what happens is that I think there's a certain amount of people on the fringe, like Redditors and people on 4chan and perhaps Devin Nunes, who really do believe that there is some kind of vast conspiracy, but that for everyone else, this kind of thing is basically useful as just chum to throw into the grist mill. To just spin up smoke around the Mueller investigation, create confusion, create a sort of ambient atmosphere of distrust without actually needing to prove that any of the specific claims in the memo are true, right? Like what's going to happen is this thing is going to be released. Everyone's going to debunk it. I'm sure it will be debunked. And it'll just sort of hang over everything for a few weeks until we get, you know, the next piece of chum that's chucked into the machine.
So I don't disagree with any of that, but I wonder if, especially as midterms approach, there's an additional and distinct incentive for Republican members of Congress to buy into this stuff and repeat it back, which is that within the echo chamber for each party, there's a very tight feedback loop, right? So if a Republican member gets a slot on cable TV and gets to repeat some of the stuff, they're going to get very positive feedback from the party base. They're going to get positive feedback from their colleagues kind of backslapping, here we are all in this together. They're going to get positive feedback from Republican donors who want to see, you know, consolidated support around the president. And all of this helps them feel stronger and more confident going into a midterm election that at the national level looks pretty tricky for the Republican Party. And so I think that, you know, it's important for us to always take a look at that stream of logic around the increased tribalism of partisan politics, you could do a similar analysis for different things on the Democratic Party side and see those same kind of feedback loops in operation. But increasingly, I have to say, I'm not sure it's as much about throwing crap at the other side as it is consolidating your own support.
I also want to touch just briefly on Andy McCabe, the number two, stepping down at the Bureau. And it was expected, we should say, that he was going to retire. In fact, it had been essentially reported, if not announced, that he would be leaving in March. But he leaves a little bit early, according to reports, including the Post and the Times, following a meeting that he had with the FBI Director Christopher Wray, in which Wray discussed this ongoing Inspector General's investigation, which relates to the FBI's handling of the Clinton email investigation. And Wray just decided to go ahead and to leave now. I mean, what do you all think is the significance of any of his departure, and kind of how are you reading? You know, there's the political fallout of such a move, but there's also just the bureaucratic machinations that are going on here. You know, Wray was going to leave, or sorry, McCabe was going to leave. It's just that this is precipitated by now this new insertion of the Inspector General report.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about the pressure that Chris Wray must be feeling from the White House and from the Attorney General himself, and, you know, the importance of his resisting that political pressure. So you could read this as him caving and saying to McCabe, look, you've got enough leave vacation time saved up. Can we just, you know, relieve you of command and you can be on vacation for the next 2 months? Do me a favor, right? And that would be upsetting. But I actually think that what I've found most upsetting in the reporting around McCabe's departure and what preceded it is the revelation that John Kelly, the White House chief of staff, while President Trump was in Davos, Kelly was tasked by Trump to call repeatedly to the Justice Department, to the Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General, and push them on the need to clean house at Justice and the FBI. And just first of all, the fact of that degree of communication between the White House Chief of Staff and the Attorney General is a violation of all kinds of norms. But secondly, the intensity of view from the White House that it demonstrates and their willingness to twist arms like that. That's the thing I find most disturbing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think it, we haven't seen any sign that, you know, Wray received a message from the White House that McCabe had to go now or anything like that. But it does speak to the amount of pressure that he's under. And my read on it, and this is a total hypothesis, but if you're Wray, I can see how this can look like kind of a win-win for you, right? Because you know that there's this Inspector General report, which, by the way, is not completed yet,
right?
Which is an important caveat here. You know that we have no way of knowing how serious the concerns that have been raised about McCabe's conduct are. The Post reported on them, but we don't know how seriously the Inspector General is taking them.
Right, so, we reported that there was like a 3-week gap from the time that the FBI becomes aware of the emails on the
Wiener laptop right.
And they are investigating, but it's not clear what the gap
right.
was about.
Exactly, right. And the investigation's not complete. So, but what I would say is, if you're Wray, you can say, okay, McCabe has basically been used as target practice by Fox and by the president for the last few months. I've already come under an enormous amount of heat. I've had to put my job on the line to keep him, right? This Inspector General report is going to come out. I'm going to get, you know, maybe bits will leak. I don't know. I'm going to get an enormous amount of shit for having McCabe there, even while he just, you know, he has a few months left before he goes. And that's going to put me in trouble because I'm going to have to put my neck on the line again. And if I actually want to quit, that's a pretty big bomb to set off. Yeah. On the other hand, now I can say I have these concerns about your behavior that show up in the Inspector General report that's underway. Apparently, he offered McCabe a demotion, essentially, and McCabe chose to leave instead. But now he can say, I didn't push him out because of pressure from the president. I was just concerned about these Inspector right. General allegations. Right. So he can kind of have it both ways.
There's a cover there.
Exactly. Yeah. So in terms of if we're talking about sort of bureaucratic machinations, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it allows him to keep the bullet in the chamber if he ever really does need to break the glass and resign.
And just as a last point on things that give cover, I think there's a lot of speculation that the president, who said last night at the State of the Union address on a hot mic that 100% he's going to have the memo released, would use the memo as some kind of a cover for firing Rod Rosenstein. And so obviously we'll have to see what's in it. But, I mean, it seems like that could, you know, is sort of in the same pattern. I don't want to attribute the same motivations to Ray as the president. But, I mean, it certainly seems like that memo will land in a moment when people are primed for the president to move to replace Rosenstein as the deputy attorney general and to try to find some justification for doing so in the findings of the Hipsey memo.
Well, and this is why, despite what Quinta said about the sort of bureaucratic logic of what Chris Ray appears to have done around McCabe, I think it's foolish.
I would agree.
I think it's foolish for somebody in Chris Ray's position to think that he comes out the other side of that and there isn't immediately pressure from the White House to do the next horrible thing.
Which we already saw when he pushed out General Counsel Jim Baker. I mean, then they went after McCabe. There's no satisfaction.
So there's not only is there no satisfaction, but each concession is merely a signal to the White House to push ahead farther. And Rosenstein is the next target. And, you know, so I think it's just a reminder of something that we've discussed a lot before in terms of the dilemmas of senior officials serving in this administration. And, you know, you hold out the hope that they have the resignation letter in the drawer and they're willing to be people of principle and stand up in the face of abuses of power. And yet what you see time and again, whether it's John Kelly or Chris Ray in this instance, is that there are compromises that they can justify to themselves for the sake of staying in the chair and holding back the flood. But each compromise actually it's death by a thousand cuts instead of death by one big gash. And, you know, I just don't think this is going to end. But can I just note that the underlying fact that leads to this memo is that the Trump administration's Justice Department renewed a FISA warrant on Carter Page.
Yep.
Okay? Like, that means
that's kind of gotten lost here.
That law enforcement still thought in 2017 that there was a reason to keep surveilling this guy. Like, oh my God.
Yeah. That is sort of the lead, isn't it? Yeah.
The buried lead.
Yeah. It's amazing that's what's gotten buried here.
Right. All right, let's move on to our next topic. Last week in the New York Times Magazine, a riveting account. We love this. We love this story, didn't we?
Oh, it's what a story. What reporting.
Yeah. By Ronan Bergman about Israel's efforts over many years to assassinate Yasser Arafat, who was the head of the PLO, of course. Ronan is sort of I don't want to call him a legend because he's not dead, but like Ronan is sort of the premier intelligence and national security reporter in Israel, you know, the kind of the chronicler of the spy services, and really has kind of, you know, pushed out a kind of a tour de force with this article. Tamara, I want to get your reaction to it first. I mean, well, I'll just say the one thing that struck me was, aside from just the narrative verve of this piece, it was fascinating to see the real conflict and the grappling that many Israeli officials were having with whether to go out and essentially get Arafat, and I mean, maybe even get him before he became sort of the heroic national world figure that he became, and to the point at which he becomes so big and so important that it's almost too dangerous to kill him because of what that would incite. I would love to get your reactions to that. It seemed to me that was the dilemma at the heart of this kind of mission was just really sussed out in this piece in a vivid way.
So, yeah, I think that there were two things that were really interesting about it. Bergman frames it in the article as the Israeli security establishment really wrestling with issues of, you know, targeted killing and democracy and a free society and what does it mean to do this sort of thing. I have to say that's not quite how I understood it reading through the article. I think it was much more a set of debates about the cost benefit, the political cost to Israel, the reputational risk for Israel involved in carrying out a targeted killing of somebody who, as you just noted, Shane, was increasingly becoming a kind of folk hero in the Palestinian movement, of nationalist movement, of course, and more broadly among, you know, leftist nationalist movements and Arab nationalism and so on over the course of the 1970s and 1980s. But it's also a story about how Israel's various attempts to weaken and to target Arafat actually helped build him up, help create that reputation as some kind of folk hero. And so that to me was a really interesting portrait. And the fact that people in the Israeli security establishment, all up and down the chain of command, were having arguments and using bureaucratic stratagems, you know, to try and push their point of view about political and reputational risk. That to me was really interesting. And so this gets to the other point that I think is really well illuminated by this piece, is the iconoclasm of the Israeli security establishment. Mm. It's one of the things that makes Israel's military and intelligence structure very, very different culturally from other highly effective, capable democratic states. It's legendary in Israel, is, you know, they have this ethos that they call purity of arms, that they use force and they use, even if they use horrible means like assassination, for moral purposes. Even junior commanders have a certain degree of freedom in the Israeli military to argue with their superior officers. And so this magazine article opens with an anecdote about the guy in charge of an operation, an Air Force operation that's targeting a plane that supposedly has Yasser Arafat on it. And he's basically like bullshitting his commanders in order to stall for time and demanding that the Mossad go back and get more intelligence.
Right, to make sure it's actually Arafat on the plane.
Right, and this is, you know, this is not the kind of thing you would see in the U.S. chain of command. Mm. It just doesn't work that way. We're much more hierarchical. We're much more respectful of authority. And you can see the benefits, but also the dangers of that kind of system at work.
We've talked about the show Fauda on the show, before, the podcast before, too. Same kind of thing that comes across in that. Yeah, it's, you're totally right to point that out. It's almost like you're reading these exchanges going like, wait, how does this work exactly? Right.
Well, the thing is, when I started watching Fauda, and part of this is because of the language barrier, because I know neither Arabic nor Hebrew, I actually had a lot of difficulty figuring out who was in command, because they're just all arguing all the time.
They're all yelling at each other right. all the time about this stuff. Yeah. I mean, Quint, I'm curious what you think, too. I mean, without the... I mean, you write a lot at Lawfare, of course, about like law of armed conflict and IHL and targeted killing. I mean, the sort of the it struck me that, I mean, there was the Israelis are grappling with the legal dimensions, but also the political and also the moral. And it's like they're kind of all in the same mix a little bit. That also seems distinct from, I guess, the way that traditionally in the United States we think about these kind of counterterrorism operations, where we kind of try to hive them off into these different categories, maybe?
Yeah, what I was actually struck by, I mean, in my pre-Trump life, the stuff that I wrote about for Lawfare, as you say, was really writing about President Obama's approach to targeted killing, where he sort of very intentionally presented himself as someone who took not only the legal, but the moral questions really, really, really seriously on a personal level as the commander in chief and really wrestled with them. And you can argue about to what extent that's performative and to what extent it was genuine, possibly both. But what I was struck by in this is that it's that same kind of pulling the moral and legal questions together and sort of mixing them up and really feeling the pain of the decision, except where Obama very intentionally sort of pulled that all into himself as the commander in chief. I mean, if you look at the way that the targeting process was designed, they involved the president to, I think, a pretty unprecedented extent. Difficult decisions would go to him personally. And that he sort of took that on as the burden of being the president. And my critique of it was that there's a loneliness to that, that he's saying, I'm alone at the top and only I can make this terrible choice. And therefore, I bear the burden on my shoulders, et cetera. Here, it's sort of everyone in the chain of command is wrestling with it on every level, which I think is what Tammy gets to, which is so, I mean, to me, as someone who my academic background is in moral philosophy, is just totally fascinating as a case study beyond the, just insane hijinks that are described in this piece.
Yeah, the hijinks also, we should emphasize.
There are many.
It is a caper in many ways. Some of them were just kind of gobsmacking to the plans, where there was the plan early
on. The Manchurian candidate plan?
Well, yeah,
Oh my God.
They're going to turn someone against, to go in and
they're
going to
like program someone
right.
to.
And it lasted for like 3 days and he turned himself in. And then they were going to blow up Arafat on a stage at a rally in a stadium.
They were
going to
blow up like
and then blow
the
up the stadium. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then a plane that he was on, like a commercial jet.
Right. With
other passengers.
On it.
One of the things it made me think about too, is there this kind of like, you know, kill the baby in the crib metaphor, right? Of, get Arafat early, kind of.
Well, there is actually a baby who dies in the crib too.
Well,
like
there's that. That's it's got everything in this story. And it did make me think about that there is that kind of operational philosophy when it comes to targeted killing strikes. Right? We used to say things like, the number three in Al-Qaeda is like the most dangerous position there is, right?
Right, because we've killed that person
yeah,
several
so
times.
Many times, yeah. And somebody just keeps moving into it.
Well, and I think that was one of the kind of underlying messages in the piece that Bergman doesn't make it explicit, but it's clearly something I think he's trying to demonstrate in the piece, is the futility of targeted killing as a sort of, with one stroke collapse a movement.
Right.
Someone like Yasser Arafat doesn't become the leader of a movement, simply because he's skilled. It's because he represents something.
Right.
And that something is real and it doesn't go away even if the man himself has died. And, if you want proof of that, look at the Palestinian National Movement since Arafat's death. It hasn't gone away. Right. Although there are certainly... I think Israelis who would make the argument that as long as the Palestinians don't have an effective, coherent, consolidated leadership, it's much easier for Israel to deal with the Palestinian problem. And that was the argument that many made on behalf of Arafat's assassination in the 70s and 80s, according to this article. But if you look at the situation today where the Palestinian leadership is weak, it's contested, it's largely viewed as using corrupt and abusive tactics to remain in power, in the face of its weakness. And that's not a gift to Israel, actually. That is a problem for Israel. And especially, as we look ahead to the inevitable departure of Mahmoud Abbas as the simultaneous head of the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, and the Fatah movement, which is the positions Arafat held as well. I don't think it makes Israelis' lives any easier to have Palestinians who have national aspirations and intense sentiment with no leader that Israelis can talk to.
I mean, I will say, again, I don't want to draw parallels that are too direct between the American and the Israeli cases, but there are parallels, obviously. And This debate over whether or not targeted killing of leadership makes sense is definitely something the United States has seen, too. As Shane says, that, we keep picking off the number three of Al-Qaeda. Like, is that really a good strategy? That there are similar questions. It's on a very different scale. And obviously the fact that the number three of Al-Qaeda is across the ocean means that there's the ambience is different.
Yeah, and I think it's worth remembering, too, that the period covered in this Bergman piece, the 1970s and 1980s, is a period when Arafat's PLO and factions that he had direct control over and was supporting were engaged in horrific acts of terrorism, international terrorism, raids into Israel that killed civilians, that killed children. hijackings. This was the heyday of international terrorism that led to the first institution of airport security screenings, for example. And so the Arafat that the Israelis were targeting at that time was much more like the leadership of Al-Qaeda to the United States now than the Arafat that existed at the time of his death.
So had Arafat been wearing a Strava or other smart fitness tracker, it would have been
alternate history.
Much easier for the Israelis to solve this problem.
Yeah, because apparently it's you can't just see where people have been. You can actually scrub the data and figure out who they are.
And where they've been over time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is, I will confess, I'd never heard of Strava. Or is it Strava or Strava?
I've never heard of it either, and my conclusion is that I should exercise more.
Yeah, right?
So
Strava. It's Strava, Matt says. Okay.
Okay.
So it's like a Fitbit, right? It's like a fitness tracker, right, Matt?
It's not a device itself. It's an app.
It's a platform.
It's a platform.
Yeah.
And my friends who are like serious triathletes and stuff love it.
Okay. So apparently U.S. troops overseas love it. Security officials not so much because it has this wonderful feature where it will show you using GPS exactly where you've been running or jogging or hiking. And then apparently that information can be obtained by people who are not you and can essentially give people a literally kind of a roadmap straight into where sensitive U.S. facilities are overseas. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I was in a way when I saw this story, I thought like, I'm kind of surprised this hasn't been a thing already. I mean, I got a Fitbit for Christmas like 2 years ago and kind of marveled at how like, look, it'll show you exactly where you went when you went running. Like, this doesn't seem safe at all.
So, yeah, I think that's amazing. And part of what's great about it, great, terrifying, interesting about this story is that this feature, which is not a flaw, it's a feature.
It kind of is the app.
Right.
Yeah, it's this, doing this, exactly what it's
but the ability to use it for this purpose, that is figuring out where military personnel and installations are in odd places around the world, was discovered by an undergrad who was like
That's
doing
so
a paper
great.
For class and was sort of rooting around in this data. Wow.
Right? give that man a job.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think he needs to finish his degree. But I do think it's worth noting that it's not just U.S. forces that are potential, like anyone who has these things. And so a lot of my friends who have been, you know, intensely studying the maps are looking at some of these places, whether it's in eastern Syria or, you know, North Africa, and trying to figure out, okay, are these American forces? Are these Russian forces? You know, do the Iranians have Fitbits?
We don't know. It's not just Americans.
You know? So now it's like, okay, what's the Fitbit penetration rate in Sudan, right? Like, as far as like, the American presence, I think it's also worth remembering these aren't just military personnel. These are aid workers. These are diplomats. Right. These might be journalists. Like, it could be anybody.
Right.
And the utility, you know, or the security challenge, I think relates more to military because the GPS maps show patrol routes and things like that are regularized.
And it seems to me like it's We're talking about the obvious, the potential security risks to U.S. forces or to people overseas. But it also strikes me that, well, presumably some people in the intelligence community probably knew this capability existed on the market out there and would be really good if you wanted to track someone down. I mean, we sort of joked about the Arafat example. But if you knew that a particular target or someone that you were after was wearing a Fitbit device – I mean, my God, could they make it any easier for you?
So I just want to say what really amazes me about this. I mean, basically everything about this is amazing. But I mean, I went to the Strava heat map website last night. It's still up.
Yeah.
Like, you can click around. They haven't fixed anything. And
their
response to it was just like their PR response was essentially, well, you should have unchecked the permissions box.
Like, right, but isn't that the point, that the responsibility for operational security and for your data security is on you? And, you know, for a lot of people, that sharing feature is part of the attraction. Like, I can show my friends what
roots I have.
Explain that
to me. Yeah, because that's the part that I was a little bit, and I confess, it's just my own ignorance of the subject.
Okay, so I'm a runner. I'm not like a serious runner, but I like
to. You run marathons.
No, I don't. I really don't.
Only half marathons, right?
I've done a 10K.
Okay, that's a lot more than
I'm pushing 50.
What's a K?
I'll take it. But it is fun, you know, if you're going to another city and you want to know what's a good running route for your distance in that city, you can go to some of these websites where people share their running data. And you can see, like, oh, that guy did a 6-mile loop on the Charles River. That looks really awesome. Or,
oh, I see.
You know, here's how you access this trail in New York City, you know, from your hotel. You can look at other people's routes. And,
like, turning people into little cartographers.
Yeah. Or you can, like, put up your route from last weekend's long run on Facebook and say to your friends, like, anybody want to join me for this run next weekend? And your friends can look and see, is that something they want to do? So I think that for a lot of athletes in general, whether it's competition or just kind of mutual support and encouragement, that sharing feature is really, really valuable.
So that makes total sense to me. I guess what surprised me is how totally blasé Strava was about this. That I can totally understand. Of course you want to share your running routes with your friends. Like, that makes total sense. Sounds like a really useful feature. But it seems to me that the company should have thought about this.
Why is it first, their job?
Because they're developed the capability. I mean, and that they, I mean, I'm not saying that they would think about it and then say, gosh, we better not do this, but at least think about it. And the fact that they're response to these news stories is basically like, suggests to me that they are not really thinking about what responsibilities, if any, they do have here.
I guess I'm a little skeptical that that's their burden to carry. If you think about it, every one of these soldiers who has a Fitbit probably also has a GPS-enabled phone. And probably many more have GPS-enabled phones than have a GPS-enabled fitness tracker. And there are already regs that these guys are supposed to follow for OPSEC when they're deployed that specifically relate to GPS-enabled devices. And if they're not following the regs, that's on them. And the military anticipated this problem, and that's why the regs are there. Yeah. So I kind of feel like if Apple isn't liable, you know, if the people who created the capability to use GPS for Waze and for everything else aren't liable, then why is Strava liable for this? It's just not their problem.
I guess this has kind of been my bugbear over the past year with Facebook. And to be clear, when I say responsibility, I don't mean like legal responsibility or anything like that. I just mean, you know, think about it. But we have seen a kind of shift in the past year with Russia and Facebook and Twitter bots and all that, of sort of a mood in people wanting tech companies to take more responsibility for what can be done with their platforms. And I have come to think that that is probably a good thing. And so I think that I'm reacting to this in context of that there's sort of there's a tech utopianism of, you know, like, look at this amazing thing we can do. Oh, you used it for this horrible purpose? Well, that's not my problem. And I think I'm seeing it in context of that.
Got it. So I think that connects back to a discussion we had on the show like a few months ago, Shane. I don't know if you remember, about the Internet of Things and like, is your toaster going to come and get you?
Right.
And, you know, the fact that a lot of the companies that build these Internet internet connected capabilities into their devices. Don't do anything about security.
Right.
Right. That there's that I think evidences a lack of forethought, a lack of responsibility, and it creates a vulnerability that others can exploit for nefarious purposes. But I think what Strava has done here is they've created a capability that the specific capability is of use to their intended audience, and they make it very easy to disable that capability if you don't want it for any variety of reasons, privacy, security, whatever. So I feel like they've kind of done what they need to do, and the user has some responsibility too. Now, if you take that to the sort of Facebook example where you have a tech company that says, hey, we're a tech company, but they've actually become a content company in a way, then I think the balance between the responsibility of the company and the responsibility of the user is a different balance.
All right. Let's move on to object lessons.
Shane's like, enough of that philosophical discussion. Let's move on to object lessons.
My object lesson is my Fitbit. So there. I liked your philosophical discussion.
Thank you.
It was just the perfect, it was like, there was nothing else to say. It was just the perfect
Tammy and I, we
crescendo.
Got it all.
And now for you too. I'm actually going to flag as my object lesson the book that the New York Times Magazine article by Ronan Bergman that we talked about comes from, which is his new book, Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Have not had a chance to read it yet, but it's highly anticipated. And I know he's been working on it for quite some time, I think. So I think this is going to be one that rational security listeners will want to check out, even if you have or haven't read the New York Times article.
Well, and if you have, then you know this is going to be a riveting read. I mean, yeah. Among other things, it's really well written.
Yeah.
It paints this incredible picture.
Yeah, he's a great writer. Yeah, he really is. Tamara, what's your object?
So my object is a tweet.
Oh.
Short
hashtag.
And sweet.
You're the hashtag reporter this week.
I am the hashtag reporter this week. And the hashtag I'm reporting on today is hashtag I'm with Victor. Who is Victor, you ask? Victor Cha, Georgetown professor, Korea expert, and was reported months and months and months ago to be the Trump administration's nominee to be ambassador to South Korea, a rumored appointment that was widely hailed from the left, right, and center of the foreign policy world, and widely hailed in South Korea. Victor, and, you know, full disclosure, Victor came to Georgetown as a junior professor when I was in grad school. I've known him a long time. I think he's incredibly smart, incredibly thoughtful. And yesterday, the news broke that the Trump administration was not going to be nominating him to be ambassador to South Korea after all, reportedly because in a private discussion with National Security Council staff, he objected to the idea of a quote unquote bloody nose strike on North Korea. If there were any questions about the veracity of this reporting, I think they were blown out of the water by the fact that Victor today has an op-ed in the Washington Post making the argument against a bloody nose strike. And sort of, you know, it's a little bit of a see you later, guys. Message to the Trump administration. But the tweet is a tweet from my colleague here at Brookings, Jung Pak, who's our Korea expert. She kind of kicked off a little bit of a hashtag last night when the news broke about Victor's non-nomination. She wrote, if Victor Cha opposes preventive strikes and ripping up CORUS, the Korean-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, then hashtag I'm with Victor. And I think most Korea experts would agree strikes are not going to achieve denuclearization. And all through last night, including through the State of the Union and its obstreperous words on North Korea, the hashtag I'm with Victor was trending in D.C. So, Victor, much respect.
Sounds like he knows how to make a hashtag happen.
That's good. That's a nice, like, counterexample of Twitter used for good instead of for evil.
That's right.
And speaking of evil, it's that time where we have to stop the podcast. Terrible.
Oh,
everyone dreads that.
That's horrific.
The end of the podcast. It's the worst part of the week.
So true.
Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. You can find our show page. I don't know. You can find it somewhere. Ben's off maybe working on transferring that show page. I don't think so.
Yeah. Do they have internet access in his undisclosed location?
I don't know where he is. Let's be honest. I have no idea where Ben is. But I'm certain he's not trying to transfer our show page.
One day, people.
One day.
Keep the faith.
You can find us on Facebook. Search for us there. Follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. Whenever you download the podcast, please remember to leave a nice rating and review. It really helps other people find the podcast. Our audio engineer this week is Matthew Kahn. Thank you for laughing at my potassium joke. I think he's the only one here who got it.
I laughed.
All right. Well,
I chuckled.
He was like visibly. He was all about it. I appreciate you. The show is produced and edited by Jen Padilla Howell. Music this week by Devin Nunes and the new Congressional Gilbert and Sullivan Performance Troupe, the Memo Sopranos.
That's what? Good. I like that.
Tam's like, what?
What? We'll see what Sophia has to say about that.
Sophia probably would play some mean Gilbert and Sullivan.
I think she
would lay it down.
She would.
I'm not sure she would be up for traveling with Devin Nunes in his performance troupe. However, I think that objectively she would be fine with a little modern major general.
Yeah, she'd play him right off stage.
On behalf of my good friends Tamar Kaufman-Wittes and Quinta Jurassic, I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.